Do you have a conclusion?
No, I don't have that. No, I don't. I just trail off like songs from the 80s.
Just keep repeating it.
Just we get the refrain over and over. Yeah.
Live from the Mundangerous Glory Days in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 363 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're getting nostalgic for the good old days. Spoiler alert, they weren't. But first, the party bounces back in the Gates of Morning campaign. And later, Rufio crows in the Character Creation Forge. So Shane, very briefly, I would just like to touch on something. So our recording schedule is garbage right now. So it's very possible that when this episode actually goes to air, it will all be old news, I guess, but I think it will still be relevant. So not to give this person too much air time, but there's a person named Gabe Hicks who did some things. We're not going to get into it, but did some things that are not great in the community to other people. Pretty crappy. The response to what this person did has been pretty resounding and complete in that they have been dropped from the streams that they have been on. They have been divested from the business that they were a part of, et cetera, et cetera. These are all good things. But I would just like to point out that, I don't know, it feels like we can't just have unequivocally good things in tabletop because then people got racist. Because here's the thing, he's black. And so, of course, what happened is there was then a groundswell of people saying, for example, things like, well, this is why you shouldn't have black people at your table. Now, is that everyone? No, of course not. Is the discourse along those lines far too much and too easy to find or stumble across? Or too loud? Yes, absolutely, of course. And I'll say, here's like the little thing that like put my flag up, right? I didn't know about this person. And like, you know, we, both of us have been pretty vocal. Like we don't really watch APs, like actual plays, you know, streams, things like that. So was not aware of this person or their work, but I heard, hey, someone did some bad things and they've been, you know, booted out of everything. And I was like, great. It does seem a little strange how quickly this happened and how completely this happened, given that, like, I don't know, there are actual literal neo-Nazis working in this industry who are still working and people still give them money. Lots of people have done quite a few bad things and they are still working. We shall not name names right now, but, you know, I don't know if you see us at Gen Con or something. We've definitely talked about it.
Well, also, some of those people recently lost their jobs at Wizards, so, you know.
But it like put a little flag up in my head when I was like, wow, that happened quickly. Interesting. And then, of course, I found out, oh, it's a black dude. Of course, that's, of course, like that is why this is the person that we're okay with booting from the industry. And again, should it have happened? Like, should they be booted? Yes. But it does always seem to be the person of color in tabletop who is made an example of. And look, you don't have to listen to either of us, right? Like I am mentioning this because we are one of the few like POC owned podcasts in this industry. So I do feel like some responsibility to talk about this, but like go listen to pretty much any black creator in this space and they'll tell you the same thing. Like it definitely is rubbing people the wrong way, but it is also not surprising. So unfortunate. I'm unhappy about it. Maybe it's a good thing that we're recording this like 2 weeks after like I put this in the notes and I'm like less inflamed about it, you know, but there it is. So yay.
I can't even find the discourse anymore because I refuse to update my Twitter app. So
that's probably a good thing.
I've apparently missed this entire thing, but I'm sorry that it has affected you so negatively.
Well, it has bubbled up on TikTok on my For You page. I think there has been a good...
See, this is the other thing. Never do TikTok. I think we've solved the problem.
There
just we go. Never TikTok.
We're done. I think the backlash to the backlash was good and also resounding. So good work, everyone. Like, bad that racists bubble up too easily in this hobby, very good that they often get squashed back down. So props.
I don't know how to elegantly transition from that. So, Ishan, where are we at the Gates of Morning campaign?
So, the Gates of Morning campaign is our 5th edition D&D game set in Eberron, a sequel of sorts to the original Morning Glory campaign. And deep in the Demon Wastes, the party is trying to stop the quarry from finding the Gatekeeper's seals and unleashing the Chaos of Zoriat onto the Material Plane. Flames burn as the Baelor's whip tighten around Switch's neck and chest. With an almost casual flick, the demon reels her in, but the stab from the lightning sword never comes. Instead, the Baelor retreats, stepping backward into the deep lava pool, dragging Switch along with it. She bursts into flame as she is pulled beneath the surface, screaming as she dies.
As her flesh burns away, a strange calm falls over Switch.
"The failure of this vessel is imminent,"
intones a quiet, unhurried voice of Primus.
"Recommend partial optimization, but I will be unable to render assistance again."
Not much of a choice, Switch thinks, and before her jaw melts off, she shouts, "Yes!" though no sound escapes the molten rock. Above, the party watches in horror as Switch disappears beneath the surface. A cackle from the Mind Seed Gersi echoes across the chamber, and the combined forces of the quarry and fiends bear down on them.
The ground begins to quake, and the lava pool buckles before it explodes in a shower of burning slag. Switch, newly healed and shining with the radiance of order, emerges from the crater, and with a single premeditated motion that she knows will strike true, she skewers the Baelor. Improbabilities align to create a perfect attack with perfect results. The ensuing cascade of divine energy all but washes the Baelor away.
But in death, it returns the favor. Before crumpling to the ground, the corpse of the Baelor explodes. With perfect timing, Switch sidesteps the brunt of the inferno, leaving just the hem of her cloak singed. Then the power of Primus leaves her forever. She is diminished, but alive and whole. Gersi hucks the now useless orb at Vesicod, who deflects it with a telekinetic flick.
And we'll find out what happens next. Next week.
So this week we are reaching back into the distant past and talking about tapping into nostalgia, which is relatively easy to do. You're probably already doing it in your games. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, like your favorite character that you're playing right now is totally a callback to some TV show or like a favorite character from your table from years ago. If you're running a campaign, you have definitely like put in some callbacks to stuff that people are going to recognize. Every campaign is Star Wars, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, callbacks, what do you mean? I lifted wholesale.
I don't change anything. Same names.
Well, I mean, you don't have to scribble that much over it to obscure the source. Like, players are not that clever. I literally ran a whole book out of the Dan Abnett series.
Look, I have notes later here. Death of media literacy. Okay, yeah, people aren't going to get it, okay? And it's fine.
I did not piece this together why we were doing this episode at this time until you mentioned before we started recording that you just finished X-Men 97.
Yeah, I'm up to date.
A show revitalizing a childhood cartoon for us that I thought I had seen just about every episode of, but when I watched a recap of, realized I'd only seen like 5 or 6 episodes several times.
Right, and given that it was on Fox, you probably saw those episodes multiple times each.
Right, exactly.
But look, we'll use it as examples, but X-Men 97 is probably a masterclass in this, tapping into nostalgia. Let's just touch on the appeal. Like, why would you do this intentionally in your game? Lots of reasons. It's an easy way to channel common touchstones, right? Like, depending on the makeup of your table, you might have people from different backgrounds, from different towns, right? Like a lot of people get groups together in college. If you're meeting people online, like, you may have almost nothing in common other than the fact that you play tabletop RPGs, and especially now online groups, like you can game with people in other countries, people you've never met in person, right? And that's less of a complication if you're playing, like, I don't know, World of Warcraft, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when you are role playing together, it's a nice, convenient, easy way to sort of knit a group together is to throw in things that all of you recognize, references, characters, themes that are shorthand that you all now, it's sort of like mini railroading for your mind, right? You're like, oh, I understand where this is going, what this character is here to do, and I can get on board and we're all on the same page. Done. Also, it's easy to crib. It's much easier than writing everything from whole cloth, because also you can't create anything new entirely, right? Like, you're going to create things when you write a campaign that have already been done before. Why not do it in a way that was really good and everyone's going to be happy about it as soon as they recognize what you're doing?
Well, so does that count as tapping into nostalgia if the source material is obscured?
Interesting.
Do you not need to have to be able to point to the source in order to invoke the nostalgia? It's not the shape of the form. It's not like the shape of the art that you recall, right? It's not, oh, the arc of the X-Men that I wanted to, it's the X-Men, right? Like, it's those characters, those iterations of the characters that make you nostalgic for that show, right?
I think yes, right? Like, if you did a character that was just the X-Men plot, but not the X-Men, then I think that is probably not nostalgic in any way, right? If you did the X-Men in a totally different plot, I think that is nostalgic, but that really, it drives to the point of like, what is nostalgic for people at your table? And, you know, that changes depending on your table, but I think the main thrust is tapping into and capturing the heart of why people remember something from a long time ago. And, you know, a lot of the shared nostalgia that a lot of us feel is from, you know, big media, right? TV and video games and movies. But it doesn't have to be. Like I mentioned before, it could just be callbacks to or nostalgia for the very first campaign that we all played together, right? Way, you know, back in high school, right? Like, you know, it depends on the specifics of your table. But I think if it is subconsciously nostalgic and people enjoy it, as long as eventually the reveal comes, oh, that is what we were doing. Oh, that makes sense. Why it felt familiar, why it felt comfortable, why the path laid out for us felt intuitive, then I think it counts.
I think you touched on something with the appeal of nostalgia that's important, right? Is like, what's appealing about nostalgia is the feeling that it invokes, not necessarily the like form or function of whatever it is that causes it, right? Like, it's not the 63 Cadillac that you're in love with. It's the feeling of being 16 with your first car that you're in love with.
Yes. Right?
The freedom that comes with that. And like the sudden, like the feeling that like your world has just opened up and you could go and do anything, right? Like, that's the appeal of the car. It's not that it had the perfect, you know, architectural or like aerodynamic lines. It was just a car.
Right. And look, we'll get to this, but like, it probably didn't have...
Well, right.
Maybe it did. Maybe it had the perfect lens when it was bought, but when you were driving it, it probably sucked.
Right.
You know, but again, yes, the feeling it evoked in you, and that is what you're trying to bring to the table, is that feeling, that emotion. And what that means is everything that we're about to say, you can change it entirely, or this is one of the instances where it's fine if you kludge, it's fine if you hack, it's fine if you fudge. Because all you're really going for, you're not going for a recreation of the way that a story brought a bunch of disparate plot lines together, probably. You're going for that emotion that you felt when probably you were a kid.
Right. you're going for the feeling you felt the first time you saw like the sharp shark shape of the Star Destroyer like fly out of the screen, right? And like chasing down the ship, right? The moment of dread when you saw the shiny black armored cloaked Darth Vader stalk through the hallway menacingly, right? Like that sense of wonder is what you're chasing, not necessarily that like, oh, you have to have shiny black armor and a cape in order to be a convincing villain.
Although that is pretty dope.
It doesn't hurt.
I mean, right, right.
Like, I mean, look.
You know, start from what works and then, you know.
Right. Why are tieflings a fan favorite now and not previously? Why is it only after they got giant horns? Is it, I don't know, maybe Tim Curry in Legend? I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there. Just maybe an entire generation of people saw that when they were 8 and it awakened something and here we are, okay?
I best not think about that.
All right, so I'd say first piece of advice, you're looking to make an homage, not a retread. In almost every scenario, it is a bad idea to do a beat-for-beat remake of the thing that you liked. Because it's not going to hit the same way. It's not. Like, one, you're probably not an auteur. And even if what you are trying to recreate is objectively not very good, your audience is also probably not 8 years old anymore. Like, you could do beat-for-beat Star Wars again. And it's not going to be the same when like the people at your table are 25 or 35 or 45 or 55. Mm-hmm. Also, I think I'd be like, this feels like Star Wars. Like this really feels like Star Wars, but like Walmart Star Wars.
Right.
That said, you don't need to change everything. Keep what works. And sometimes you can even like not change a thing like the X-Men 97 intro theme. They change some scenes and switch out the characters depending on who's in the episode. Awesome. But the like, dun, 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 like the important part, the important part, right, is almost exactly the same.
Yeah, as long as there's 40-foot tall sentinels.
Like, I mean, obviously, like, it's all just 40-foot tall sentinels.
Right.
I mean, that's mostly what I remember from both the arcade game and yes, the TV show, right? But they, yes, they right, just doubled down.
The theme song of that, yeah.
It's like a focus group, but they were like, what do you remember? Oh, Sentinels and, I don't know, Rogue. Okay.
And Gambit's terrible Cajun accent.
And they're like, great, we're going to deliver. I don't remember Sexy Magneto, but they also apparently are delivering that. Here we are.
I mean, that's interesting because this is like the core question of adaptation, right? And like, if you're just going to recreate something shot for shot, why bother? Right.
Just watch the original.
Like, exactly. And so it's like whenever you do an adaptation, whether it's changing forms of media or like recreating media in a modern lens, like that's always like the art of it is like, what do you keep and what do you throw out? And that's always like, that's where like nostalgia becomes cynical, right? Is it's like, well, all you've done is just taken the brand, right? But I'm not nostalgic for the brand. And that's why like all of those kind of retreads have kind of failed in the past, you know, Amazon years. It's because they were just like, oh, here's an IP that people like. Hey guys, remember that? And it's like, this sucks. Please stop touching things.
Right. And look, you can't do a Michael Bay like campaign because people aren't paying to be in your game. And after every session, they're like, sorry, this sucked. Before you sort of like unroll the nostalgic elements, think about what are you changing and how are you changing it and why are you changing it? What is the twist that you're adding? And I would specifically say like, don't do like a Shyamalan twist for the sake of a twist, right? But you know, what is like the one tweak that you're making, or what is maybe the inversion that you're doing, right? Like things are all the same except for the one thing I flipped on its head, you know?
Well, right. Like why is this relevant to now? Like why are we doing this now? Because we right, could do anything. Why are we doing, you know, why are we like walking into a nostalgia trap?
Right. What is the update? And I think that look, what you just said drives toward like, what is the insight? And I think this is a thing that we maybe overlook with media or stories that like really stick with us, is they said something meaningful. They spoke to us for a reason. And part of that was like, maybe it was because we were young and impressionable, right?
Yeah, maybe it was because we were listening.
Right, yeah, yeah. I didn't have anything else to do.
Just checking our phones the whole time.
Right, right. But, or, and also, it often it is because they say something about the times that we are in or the age we are in a particular time. Right. So like, you know, X-Men actually back in the 90s was a product of its time. But if you look at, I'm not going to call it a remake, right? The sequel, if you look at X-Men 97, it is a product of our time, even though it is set in 1997. So yes, there are nostalgic bits like, hey, look, it's a Walkman with a cassette in it. Ah, ha, ha, ha. And there are, you know, console video games with a joystick controller, whatever. But if you just look at, for example, the character of Magneto, what was he back in the original show? He was a terrorist. He was the bad guy, right?
Sort like of.
He was. Well, that's,
like
and
half
that's the
show, he was the bad guy.
But he was the one like, there's Professor X, and he's like begrudgingly fighting against Magneto,
right?
Which is, and it's much easier to have like a Magneto who is an unequivocal bad guy in 1996, but you take him and you don't even really change his views and you put him in 2024 and he doesn't really look like the bad guy anymore, you know, because the times have changed. And, you know, in the past, whatever, 30, 40 years, the comic books have recognized that as well, right? That's why they're able to like have this storyline for him in 2024. It's that, you know, all of these elements already exist in the comics because people are like, he really feels more like an anti-hero. I don't know that he's wrong necessarily, right? Okay.
Yeah, we do kind of like the mutants after all.
Right. Yeah, and we would like them not to get genocided. That does seem like sort of like on the face of it a good thing, right?
Right.
Also, humans really seem like they suck. Who's writing the humans?
At least all the ones with power do.
Right. So in a way, like X-Men 97 reimagines the characters in the context of the new times. Like for example, like a lot of the old media that we watched was pretty misogynistic. It was pretty homophobic. And it is, you could call it an inversion. You could call it an update, but you can also just calling like viewing it through the lens, like through a current lens. If you just remove that stuff when you're updating it, right? It doesn't need to exist. It doesn't add to the discourse. It doesn't, and that like that's really not the thing that we're nostalgic for, right? And in fact, it can be very jarring when we're like, wait, I didn't remember this part. I blocked it out, right? Because like I'm a good person and I also liked this thing, and like I kind of want to forget that it's from 1984.
You've watched James Bond recently.
Revenge of the Nerds, Indiana Jones. Yeah. And at the same time, like the character of Magneto is kind of an inversion. They're like, wait, he was the antagonist. Now he's the protagonist. We're telling a lot of this like from his perspective.
I think the other important part of leveraging nostalgia is to know your audience, right? And understand what's going to resonate with them. Something you just mentioned is like, they set it 97. In order to set the time period, they had to invoke some of that like nostalgic element of the Walkman, right? A concept that makes no sense to people who grew up with only a cell phone in their pocket. But yeah, like, you know, you used to put headphones on over your ears and walk around with a tape player clipped on your belt. And like that reminds me of childhood. I am like, that appeals to me, right? Like that frames this, that puts me in the mindset of like, I was a child then. I'm going to kind of see this through something like kid-like eyes because of how you've sort of framed this modern story, right? It's like, it's kind of primed me for appreciating it in the right context of how I originally fell in love with the series. And I think when you're at a table, you can do some of that in real time, right? Like you look at how your players are responding to the like kind of elements of nostalgia that you're invoking, and you lean into the ones that start to resonate, and you can kind of bypass the ones that didn't, right?
Yeah, and the way this can work, like again, you're at a table, so it's you can see what works, right? You like you do one session and then you can get feedback. You can drop a little bit, a few references, see what lands, see what hits, see what people notice and pick up, and then, you know, go back and feed them more of that, right? Like, I'm running Scum and Villainy, right? Blades in the Dark, Star Wars, right now for our home group. And I did not know that Steph has only seen a Star Wars, just the one.
She's very confused.
Right.
She's very confused.
The nostalgia elements are not necessarily working for her so much, but it means that, you know, I obviously need to bring other things to appeal to her. But also, you know, I'm trying to lean into more into episode 4 because that's the one she's seen, right? Like she's seen that and Rogue One. So
well, so she saw the two best ones. It's fine.
Exactly, right? Like we're great. Also the two relevant ones because like right. We are
the two closest to our time period.
Right. We're doing 5 BBY. So yeah. She knows what she needs to know, which is great, right? Oh, she knows nothing? Great. Your characters know nothing. At a table, the way that this can happen in practice is yes, the GM is putting these things out, but as a player, you can help build the narrative and the nostalgia. So if I say, all right, here's an NPC that you meet, right? And they're in danger on the Ferris wheel and like, you know, their Walkman falls out of their pocket and smashes to the ground, which, you know, is a scene from X-Men 97. As a player, you can be like, okay, wait, so this kid's a Walkman. I'm guessing they're wearing high tops. They must be
acid wash jeans,
right? They must be cool, right? If like in this, if they have this, like the context of having this, this item, this relatively expensive item in this particular time, like I remember, like only the cool kids had this. Is like, am I viewing this through the correct lens? You know, and you can have that conversation about like, yes, and now you're building out this NPC, the characterization of this person, and there's more to interact with. And all of that is increasing the nostalgia for the time period, right? And it also lets other people sort of like tap in to be like, oh, wait, is this true? Is this the time we're talking about? No, actually, that was 10 years before and I know you weren't born yet, that's fine. Or yes, absolutely, like, you know, this is a year before Can't Hardly Wait comes out, you've got it, you know?
That, by the way, is so funny to me that, and this is like goes to like different people remember different things about the time period, and what lands for different people. You just said that only cool kids had Walkmen because you grew up in largely the 80s and
you're
early
right.
90s.
It should probably be Discman.
For me, yeah, for me right. In the later 90s, like if you had like a Walkman was not even a brand at that point. It was just a genericized term for any portable tape player because they were $8. And a Discman was like a portable CD player was what you really wanted. And one that didn't skip every time you took two steps was like, oh, now you have something nice.
Right. Or some jerkwad tapping it while you're listening.
Right. Exactly. Like yeah, one that yeah. You could run with. Not that as a kid I ever ran on purpose, at least not with headphones on. Like that was like a luxury item.
You had to get the Rio MP3. That's pre Zune.
That was later.
That was it was 98,
something like that. Yeah
but and look, like that was outside light years of our ahead price range. In technology.
Yeah.
Well, actually, so I guess what I should take away from that scene in X-Men 97 is that kid poor,
right? Or that producer messed up.
But everyone is remembering different things, and everyone. Everyone was touched by something different and by something different in the same media, you know, right. Like, yeah, I liked the time travel shenanigans in Terminator, but what I remember is like cutting out your own eyeball. That's what I remember, you know, but that's because I watched it when I was like 6. So right.
I remember your clothes, your boots and your motorcycle. And I think that was probably the first time I saw a naked man.
And it was Schwarzenegger. Wow, that explains a lot about you.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, it's not like it was like frontal or anything, but you know, it was like, oh.
This is what you have to live up to.
Yeah, this is the peak male form.
Right.
Okay.
Protein powder ever since.
This better not cause a complex.
Another neat thing you can do, you can play around with, especially with people who like are media savvy and are interested in that kind of thing. You can do meta nostalgia, right? Where it's not necessarily just nostalgia about the story or the characters, but it's nostalgia about the people in the background, the writers, you know, and combine things like that.
What is the tabletop game equivalent of that then? Is that like including a small but vicious dog in the like in the loot for a scum tier character?
I think absolutely. Things like that, right? Like,
I mean, this is your Holy Avenger. This is your Vorpal Sword, right? Like, these are the kinds of things that you've, it doesn't matter what game you're in, like, they invoke something amongst a certain set because they were the kind of items that you strove for as you look through the DMG, right?
Right. And I think even something like a Vorpal Sword, right? Like, maybe you don't include a Vorpal Sword, but it's, I don't know, some other reference to Lewis Carroll, right? And like, if you're a longtime gamer who knows all about Vorpal Swords and then you know where the phrase even comes from, right? You put those two things together.
Sure.
If you, I think taking two kinds of media and smashing them together, I would, I would probably put Star Wars and Star Trek together in ways that they don't align or, you know, I am less reverent about 40K maybe than you because I know a lot about it, but I know less than you, right? So I tend to just sort of squish 40K references and things. But you combine multiple references to Games Workshop properties, right? And like the right player will pick up on that and get a kick out of it.
Right. So name your Vorpal Sword, the Jabberwocky.
Right, exactly. Okay, so honestly, this entire episode probably could have just been caveats about using nostalgia, but let's talk a bit about some of the caveats. The first one I think is probably just straight up knee-jerk opposition. These are sacred cows for a lot of people, and they love them because they are a foundational part of their personality in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think that nostalgia is a lot of the source of the gatekeepering.
Yes.
Or the gatekeeping behavior that like you see around a lot of these IPs, right? Like it's probably to some of the people doing it even irrational, and yet they can't help but feel uncomfortable with, speaking of, the first female Custodes has officially been canonized.
So I mean, that's great.
Been a whole meltdown.
Well, look, women in general, right? Like female Custodes, I have here in the notes, the Avatar The Last Airbender fandom is absolutely toxic if you bring up the sequel, which of course is the first main character female Avatar. She can do nothing right for these people. And I'm 100% sure like a female Custodes is going to get like, the same kind of treatment. So.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, it's all the same treatment as the female Space Marine, right? Like a thing that does not matter, except that it changed.
Right. It was all made up before. I don't know if you know that.
Though I will die on the hill of the Adeptus Astartes being named after a person is incredibly stupid. the person who created the Astartes gene seed. Her last name was Astarte.
Oh, I thought it was Astarion from Baldur's Gate 3.
No, it would be less offensive to my nostalgia if it were Astarion because that guy ruins everything he touches. But yeah, how convenient is that the only part of the Imperium named after a person, like the only Adeptus named after a person happens to be one whose name means space in fake Latin. What are the odds?
This is an interesting point. Like when you're appealing to new audiences, right? And at a table, this can mean people who are not nostalgic for the thing you're referencing, but are being introduced to it for the first time as part of your reference, right? And, you know, you're dealing with 4 to 7 people at a table. Like there's an excellent chance you got somebody who's doing that. Mm-hmm. What will happen sometimes is they'll get the wrong end of it or they'll misunderstand the context or what the first iteration was about. And so they take the wrong thing away from it. A small example of this, I've seen a lot of people being like, wow, the pacing of these X-Men 97 episodes is frenetic. Like, the cuts are so quick and they're cramming so much in the episode. I'm just like, you did not see the original, did you?
Yeah, it's for children. They'll be distracted by shiny keys if you're not careful.
I remember watching the original and being like, whoa, this is really fast. Like, give a sentence space to breathe. No, we got too much to say.
I think when you talk about bringing on board new audiences into your nostalgic material, you run into the friction of the rose-colored glasses, right? Where what you remember and what's actually on the page of the text are in conflict, right? And it's hard to convey that, like, what's appealing about this media to you is not what it says. It's what it represents to you, right? And this is like, hey, you know how much awful stuff is in Star Wars? like racism, sexism, slavery.
I thought you were talking about the writing, but yes, also stuff.
That too. But like, yeah, I mean, all of that stuff. Like, right, it's just like so much of Star Wars is really bad. And yet it all came together for people of the right age, right, into this like truly transportational fantasy. If you came into Star Wars today with more of a modern lens, I don't know that a lot of those things are that appealing to you. And a good example of that is in the Han Solo, like in Solo, a Star Wars story or whatever, right? When they like turned the droid into the Millennium Falcon, and it's like, wait, that's a sapient creature that you've just trapped in a machine. Like, that's like really super invasive. And yeah, I get it. That's totally in line with Star Wars. Like, I don't have any trouble that it doesn't belong in Star Wars. It's just like really jarring to a modern audience in the way that, like, if Han had done that in 1976 or whatever, like, yeah, we'd probably just shrug and be like, yeah, it sucks to be a droid, huh?
right.
You don't even think about restraining bolts back then.
Right. I mean, the you just look at the entire treatment of droids throughout Star Wars history, and it is apparent that they're supposed to just be robots and comedic relief.
Right.
But it really becomes obvious that, like, they have emotions. This is awful and horrific.
Right.
Well. And then you have other writers being like, I should probably write a droid liberation storyline, huh? Yeah, well, this seems to make no sense. That wouldn't exist. Huh? Yeah. This, I don't know, maybe I'm going to get in trouble for this. This is the whole reason that, like, OSR exists, right? I mean, it has to be. Because, like, these old systems were not good.
Right. It's trying to invoke that feeling that you had, that you remember having as a kid. Not the real thing. Right. It's trying to make you feel like you felt when you first played role-playing games. Regardless of what you actually saw on the page, that's not important.
But the caveat, right, the pitfall here is that so many of these OSR games do that by trying to recreate the mechanics of these old systems.
Right.
And that doesn't give you the feeling of it, because when I was, you know, 14, it hit different when I lost a joke character named Eni Kamozi, the hot steppa, you know?
I don't know what that's a reference to, but I'm really happy for you that you got to make that joke on the air.
No, it was a ridiculous character, but like, you name a character that who was, you know, singing a track on Hot 97, you aren't really that concerned when they die, you know, as opposed to a character you make when you're older and care more and are, you know, trying to play this in like the bare minimum of like free time that you have, and you like put a backstory into them. The grinder is not as fun.
Exactly. It's like, it's funny to me because, like, if I were creating my own personal OSR, right? Like, the ultimate bad guy would be a Boulette, because I scarred my friends with an arena fight against a Boulette in which they just didn't figure out how to deal with it before it TPK'd them. And like, that is an end boss for them, right? they were so mad at me for killing their characters. Like, that's like core memory of gaming unlocked for them. Like, if I were to say like, oh yeah, this is an old school game and it didn't have something like that, that would be deeply upsetting to them. But if I then published that and sold it as an OSR game and was like, yeah, I mean, bullets were deadly, you know? And like, no one agrees with me. Right. Like, there are five people on Earth who agree with me.
Right. Did you just make the rulers of your universe on kegs?
Perhaps.
What's happening?
There's a rust monster with your name on it.
Look, I'm seeing a lot of discourse about how 5th edition D&D is like board game D&D. It's for babies. And really, the best iteration of D&D was 4th edition, which really lets the monsters shine. And
wait, really?
Yes,
5th
yes,
edition is
literally.
Board game D&D? The best edition was MMO D&D? What?
That, see, and these are people who either didn't play the old one or they played it for a little bit but didn't slog through 5 years of it.
Right.
And of course, there's...
Here's what it is nostalgia is the stuff you experience before the discourse, right? They played 4th edition and didn't know any different, and it didn't matter because they weren't plugged in, and therefore it's the best edition, right?
Except for 3.5, which is apparently also the best edition, so...
Well, right. In case you were onboarded into 3 or 3.5, of course it's the best edition because it was what you experienced before the discourse.
I think it's probably more difficult at a like multi-generational table because so much of this is like age cohorts, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
At your table, it probably does mean, like you mentioned this before, like sometimes you're just going to really need to spell things out. And like, look, if you drop a hint, if you drop a crumb, if you make a callback or reference and people don't get it, it's fine. You don't even need to explain it. You don't need to be like, oh, you guys didn't even catch up on the fact that the answer to the puzzle is from, like, it doesn't. Doesn't matter, and that shouldn't be the only clue, you know? You should be able to experience and enjoy whatever game you're playing, even if the nostalgia doesn't work or doesn't hit. You're doing it already, all right? You are relying on nostalgia sometimes for entire sessions, for entire characters that you are playing to make sense or to be like a hit with other people at the table. Tez Proudgale in our actual play, why did you, Shane, bring along Meepo, the kobold, the useless kobold?
That is a very good point because I am super nostalgic for Meepo because when I played Sunless Citadel as a child with my like friends growing up, Meepo was the character I got to play because I was the DM. So Meepo is a hero to me.
So you're doing it already and it's good. Just try to be more purposeful with it.
Well,
and
right, but like also our Meepo is very different from Meepo that like my nostalgia Meepo, right? And I think that's also part of it is that like we've let it breathe, right? We didn't wrap my nostalgia for this character around who it was going to become. Like, Meepo is your character. He's important because I chose him, but like what he became, I had nothing to do with, right? Like, you made Meepo who Meepo is.
Well, I mean, you were the mirror that he reflects off, right? You know?
Sure. But like, that has nothing to do with my core memory of Meepo, right? Like, Meepo is not a suave and debonair Lothario in my like nostalgic headcanon for Sunless Citadel.
Maybe he always was. That's the subtext of Sunless Citadel.
Yeah, sure. He's a sniveling, like, appeasing, incompetent kobold. Like, right? Like, that's how he's written. That's who he is. Like, we've made him more than that, mostly because I was interested in that. But it's grown far beyond, like, anything that I would say is, like, mine, right?
And I would say, don't let your nostalgia for something be the boundaries of what it can be in your game. It,
exactly.
Make it the jumping off point and then grow from there. That's the best thing about tabletop is you can iterate every week.
Right. Exactly. And like, you know, I get to see what happens when you elevate Meepo, right? When you treat Meepo as like, a partner instead of the DMPC, not even the NPC that you get to kick around because you get to, you know, thumb your eye at the GM a little bit. Thumb your eye, is that?
Thumb your nose.
Thumb your nose
is where it starts. But you know, in this world, you thumb eyes.
Yeah. Well,
you bite your thumb, you bite your eye.
When we're mixing metaphors, it's probably time to leave. Do you hear that, Ishan?
Amiibo is screaming because you've tried to thumb his eye. Please stop.
Well, then let's move on to the character creation forge and see what kind of eye he gets as a replacement. But before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at EvilSenseCarne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at TotalPartyThrill.
And join the conversation on Discord. There's a link in the show notes. All right, so this week in the Character Creation Forge, we are building Rufio.
Rufio, for those of you not nostalgic for this already.
Oh, sorry. I meant Rufio.
There we go. So actually, the reason that we're doing Rufio in this episode is we recently did Avatar The Last Airbender as a campaign setting. And Shane, I don't know if you know this.
I do not.
Because you are Netflix only for Avatar. But the voice actor for Zuko, for Prince Zuko in the animated series is Dante Bosco, who you maybe know better as Rufio in Hook.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah.
And I did not know him better as that either.
So I was like, well, why have we not done Rufio? So we're doing Rufio. But
okay. He
will tell an interesting story where, so he plays Zuko, and there's, I think this was in the Netflix, they did this scene in the Netflix adaptation in the first season. He has the Agni Kai with his father, with Ozai, right? And that's the one where, like, minor spoilers, like, he gets the scar, right?
Oh,
and it's like,
right, sure.
It's like a big dramatic scene with his father, and you realize like how abusive his father is. In the animated series, Ozai is voiced by Mark Hamill, who probably most of you know as Luke Skywalker. Some
you mean
others
the
of
voice
you.
Of the Joker?
Exactly. And I was just about to say, like I said, a very accomplished voice actor, probably best known in terms of voice as, look, I'll just say it, the best Joker, like just the best Joker. Over Heath Ledger, best Joker. Heath Ledger number two. Okay. So Dante Bosco says, all right, he's voicing Zuko. They're going to do the Agni Kai. He knows like, oh, it's going to be a big scene with his father. And he's in the recording booth. And they say, all right, we're going to send Mark in to do your father. And he's like, cool. Who's Mark? I don't know. Cause it was a big secret. Right. And Luke Skywalker walks in. He's like, Luke Skywalker walks in. And then we like do the scene, except that like the scene is basically Vader and Luke, except that Mark Hamill is now playing Vader. And Dante Bosco is sitting here going, I just did the Vader and Luke scene with Luke Skywalker as Vader. What is my life? And like, that is a bit of meta nostalgia for people who like watched the original series and like knew the voice actors and like what they had done before, right? If you knew like, oh, Mark Hamill is Ozai, what is it? What am I watching? So Rufio is a character added to the Peter Pan lore in the 1991 Robin Williams movie, Hook.
Which a Steven Spielberg joint about the nostalgia of your own childhood, huh?
Julia Roberts was Tinkerbell, Dustin Hoffman was Captain Hook. And Robin Williams plays a Peter Pan who's all grown up and has forgot who he is and has gone to the real world and gotten married and had kids and become a lawyer. And he ends up back in Neverland and he has to rediscover who he is. But the current leader of the Lost Boys is Dante Bosco's Rufio, who like rides a wind skateboard, and fights, with a sword.
He can fly.
He actually can't fly. Right. And it's one thing Rufio never does is fly.
Right.
And that's how we find out that Peter Banning is, in fact, the Pan, because
the Pan,
he learns to fly, right? But let's talk about Rufio for a bit, right? Now, I went back and forth about, like, obviously, he's a swashbuckler, right? I don't think that Rufio is a rogue, and it is because we don't really see him. We see him be very acrobatic, but we don't see him dancing around. We see him basically point at a lot of people and say, "Kill the pirate."
Yeah. I mean, he does embarrass Peter at the beginning to show mm-hmm. off his skill, but he doesn't really deploy that in battle.
Now,
in fact, he loses his only sword fight, doesn't he?
He does, but let's get to that. So I also don't think he's a bard, right? He's not doing a lot of singing. Maybe crowing is bardic inspiration. But he does have a history with Captain Hook. And you see this when he does confront Hook at the end, right? The final battle. Mm-hmm. They've fought before because Hook starts saying the Rufio chant. Now, he's probably egging him on, right? He's probably trying to get him to attack him. But he only could have seen that if they have fought before and Rufio either got away. I mean, probably didn't defeat Hook, right? Hook is a master swordsman. But, mm-hmm. like, he got away and is still leading the Lost Boys. And Hook takes him seriously. He switches swords. He has, like, a basket hilt, a big, heavy sword, and he switches to a dueling rapier because he knows he has to.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Rufio is actually Battlemaster Fighter 10, Conjuration Wizard 2. Anything after that you can do, but he's probably around 12th level, I think.
Sorry. Are we Conjuration just so we can conjure a feast?
Yes, that's exactly it. That's the only reason that we have this. So you're going to start with Dex 16, Charisma Secondary as a variant human. First level feat, take Magic Initiate 4 Bard. We do not need to be a bard. We just need a feat that gives us Vicious Mockery.
Great. Love that.
Uh-huh. Because constantly, all you're doing, making fun of people, and they take psychic damage.
That's true.
For Fighter, we get a fighting style. That's dueling. Battlemaster gives us maneuvers at level 3. You end up, I think with 8. Don't quote me on that. It's a lot of them. Take these in pretty much any order. I like Commander Strike, right? Which is pointing with your sword and saying, kill the pirate. Mm-hmm. Commanding Presence, which lets you spend a die to get bonuses on charisma skill checks. Evasive Footwork, we've seen him use a couple of times. Spend a die and increase your AC while you're moving. Menacing Attack lets you frighten someone when you attack and rally grants temp HP to someone else. So there's a bit of Warlord here. But I think mostly it's just he attacks a bunch of times, he hits hard, and his ASIs... again, I think it's any order you want to do here. You want to increase your dex. You want to increase your dex once, right? Dex plus 2. Take skill expert, which gives you a plus 1 of dexterity, and expertise in acrobatics, which I think he definitely has. You like watch the opening scene, you'll see. Athlete is also good because he climbs very quickly, and that'll give you another plus 1 to dexterity, which tops you off at 20. And mobile is good too; makes you move very quickly, and you avoid opportunity attacks. He weaves through combat very well.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have 2 levels of wizard. He doesn't use magic, right? The only real magic is like Tinkerbell. So we're reflavoring these. Minor illusion you can use as like, you know, I make it look like I imagine something and it becomes real or real-ish. And weirdly, I think you can actually use True Strike, which is mostly garbage. But if you are pointing at someone and you are saying everyone else attack them, you do have a round to cast True Strike, point at them, and then the next round when you do actually attack after everyone else has attacked, you get advantage. Meh. Longstrider is good. That's just him being fast. Featherfall, pretty much all the Lost Boys could fall long distances, even though they can't necessarily mm-hmm. fly. Jump is good. Shield is just a deflection. But you're really here for the second level feature, Minor Conjuration, which lets you make non-magical items out of thin air, which you do every time you eat.
Yeah. I mean, how else are you going to get Bangarang?
How else, right? Look, just giant turkey legs. My favorite thing about that scene is when you can actually finally see the food, it has bites taken out of it.
Yeah.
Right? It didn't just show up. It has been eaten. They were already eating it.
Right.
All right. And there's Rufio.
Great. I love that. Before we wrap up, let's take a moment and thank our Patreon supporters.
Your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out all of our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill. And now, patrons at any level can get the shows ad-free.
You can also leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It's the best way to support the show and help other people find us. If you do, we'll read it on the air. So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We are talking about using Fallout as a campaign setting.
And in the Character Creation Forge,
we're building the Brotherhood of Steel.
Well, that's it for episode 363 of Total Party Thrill. I hope you lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.